Hello, Roadmen. In today's full-featured Roadman Cycling Podcast, I catch up with Trek Segafredo star Alex Kirsch. We talk Tour de France, alternate routes into cycling, life after cycling, and the pressure of being a domestique at World Tour level. Let's cue that intro.
The big question is this: how do we use cycling as a tool to improve our health, our happiness, and our longevity? That is the question, and this podcast will give you the answers. My name is Anthony Walsh, and welcome to the Roadman Podcast.
Hello, Roadman. Welcome back, Roadman. It's a full feature-length Roadman Podcast. It's been a minute since we've done one of these. The Tour de France was epic, and I still am reeling from it. But we don't have long to wait until the next Grand Tour, because the Vuelta, the Giro, kicks off on Saturday week with the World Championships this coming weekend. I cannot remember the last time someone has been as heavily fancied for both the TT and the road race as Wout van Aert going into this race. It's for all those cycling fans of the late 90s, it's probably Miguel Indurain was the last rider that went in as heavy a favourite. But the crown is heavy and the fatigue from the Tour de France is definitely real. So we see if Wout can carry the expectation of an entire country on his broad shoulders. Roadman, this is an interview that I'm excited to bring you. It's one that has been in the pipeline for a little while, but I'm glad that we got to do it now and we got to reflect on the Tour de France. We got to reflect on Jumbo-Visma's tactics, what the fatigue is like from a Grand Tour, and the reality of being a domestique in World Tour racing. Alex Kirsch is a rider from Trek Segafredo, and I'm delighted to catch up with him today on the Roadman Podcast. Before I jump into the full interview with Alex, let me just remind you to head on over to patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. That's where you can go and you can buy me the price of a beer once a month, and it supports this podcast. It does really two things. It's vindication for me the podcast is going the right direction, but also it gives us that financial support to be able to bring you these podcasts week after week, month after month, and hopefully, fingers crossed, year after year. Now we've taken care of business. It's time for the main event. Take it away, Alex. Alex Kirsch, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you.
Did you get a chance to watch much of the Tour de France?
Actually, I did. Yeah. I pretty much followed every day.
And is it a bit of a, we have an Irish saying where we say it's a busman's holiday, where like if you work in the industry, do you really want to go on a bus tour? Is it kind of like that with the Tour de France for you guys, where you're like riding the bike all day, racing every week, and then to chill out and watch the tour? Is that enjoyable or is it a bit weird?
No, I mean, it's of course it's enjoyable. It's the biggest race in the world. Obviously, if I have a training session or race, I don't need to see every stage, and I'm not really spending hours on the internet to find result sheets. But obviously, the big days are nice to watch.
Were you guys happy from a team perspective with Richie Porte stepping onto the podium?
Absolutely. I don't think that was what the team hoped for going into. I think they were going for obviously a good GC ride and maybe a stage win. They were close with the stage win, but Richie being on a podium is great for the team, but is obviously also very great for him. I think people in general, they realize it went under the radar maybe for, you know, with the fight for the victory in the last 2 days and so on, but it meant a lot for him. He has a long career and a lot of talent, and he's a bit under the radar probably through his career, but for him finishing on the podium is a big thing and makes me super happy.
I think Richie's he's a really good time trialist, and it was almost like no one was talking about this before, like, because I was looking at it and going, Lopez is shit against the clock. Richie's really strong against the clock. Landa's not great against the clock either. So it looked like a possibility going into the time trial, but I definitely didn't see Lopez going that badly.
No, he went super bad. That's true. When I was calculating a little bit the time, like I was thinking it was like 1:20, and I was saying to my wife, actually on a good day, he has this in him, and it could have been really close, as obviously it's not a flat time trial, and Lopez seemed like super strong in the climbs the last week. So in my opinion, it would have been very tight. In the end, it wasn't even, but for sure, I texted him the day before that he should go all in, and also because I believe that it was within his possibilities. Yeah, definitely.
What's the atmosphere like at Trek? Like, are you guys completely like delighted with something like that, or is it just like a colleague doing well and you're like, ah, you know what, it's good, but honestly, it doesn't really affect my life that much?
I think we have, I wasn't in many different teams, so I can't, you know, I don't have so much experience, but looking at dinner tables and so on in hotels, I feel like we sit much longer at the table speaking to each other and having a laugh more than you see maybe in other teams. So I think we are closer to each other, and at least from my point of view, I was very happy for the team and for the riders that performed well.
It looks a fun team to be on. Like, there's some teams I just look at and I think, you know what, you could not give me 10 million euro a year to go ride with Astana. It just looks no fun. You know, Vinokourov looks like a prick. The whole thing just looks terrible. But Trek just looks fun.
Yeah, I mean, for 10 million, I would consider, but yeah, I know what you mean.
obviously, I had Ryan Mullen on the podcast a while ago. He's a teammate of yours. Do you want to embarrass Ryan with any stories?
Well, I better not. There's a video. I mean, probably you've seen it already, but there's a time trial video, which I just love to see once in a while, where he just goes off the start ramp and just crashes immediately. And we did kind of a mashup video with the music behind and so on. I think it's on YouTube or Twitter or whatever. You can maybe put the link in or so.
Yeah, I'll put the link into that one. I'll go and find it. Yeah, I had Ryan on a few weeks ago on the podcast. And yeah, he's a funny fucker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
He was
talking. And a strong one.
Yeah, he's strong. And I don't know if he's coming back. We've got national championships here in like 2 weeks. I don't know if he's coming back for that or if he's racing abroad still, but yeah, he'll definitely be ripping the legs off me in that one, no doubt. You rode your first Grand Tour last year in the Vuelta. What's it like managing the fatigue through a 3-week race like that? I know the longest I've raced is like an 8-day stage race, and I know like when you're 2 days in, you're kind of looking at it and going, I've 6 days left, this sucks. What's it like when you're kind of 2 days in, you're looking at it and going, shit, I've 19 days left?
It's definitely an experience that mostly at the first one, you don't know what to expect. And I personally went into it thinking, okay, I tried to, you know, look at it a little bit scientifically and thinking, okay, it's 3 weeks, so we can't race so hard all day, it's impossible. And then like the first day was just incredibly hard, also the second one, and then I was thinking, okay, how are we going to keep going like this? And in the end, I think you pretty soon reach a point where you're just very tired, and everyone gets tired, and it wasn't really physically. It was very exhausting and tiring, but it's not something that I would be afraid of. And I think it's very doable for any rider to finish a Grand Tour. Obviously, it's harder to perform in these races, but just racing 3 weeks is more of a mental thing. And, you know, not giving up. I had like one or two days where when you just don't have it, need to fight, and that is mentally quite tough.
I see physically. Ryan Mullen was talking about the Giro last year, and he says the Giro, as an 80 plus kilogram rider, It's like a 3 week Audax like exploration type race.
Yeah, it is definitely with the I have the feeling the climbers get lighter, and so the speed in the climbs is for sure is very high overall, and also the level of the worst rider improved dramatically over the last 5 years. That's what everyone is saying, and when I talk to riders or maybe those who just retired recently, some of their values they pushed to ride in a gruppetto or in the bunch wouldn't even make you in time cut nowadays. Yeah. And so I don't think the fastest riders ride much faster, but it's more that just the worst rider is a pretty good rider nowadays. So of course, if you're 80 kilos, you just push some watts. But actually, making time cut is more a thing of pacing than really a pure. I think you just should not go too deep and explode and then lose minutes. If you ride a good speed in all the climbs, I never had problems with time cut.
Because it's something we just don't see when we're watching on the television. Just the battle that does go on at the back of the race. Like, obviously, I'm recording this here in Ireland, and we're all massively proud of Sam Bennett and the green jersey. But he had some days where the camera wasn't on him through those mountains that are going to be pretty difficult. And everyone thinks the sprinters get a rest during the mountains, but it's tough work.
Yeah, for sure. If you look at the KJs, that was something pretty impressive that I realized during the Vueltas. On some days I've finished 30 minutes behind, you know, not even having a problem with time cut or so, but just spending like 6,000 or 5,500 KJs, whereas you could see the winners, like some skinny climber spend 4,500 KJs. So it's definitely a bit of work to get these stages done.
Have you seen the stats from Pogacar on La Plata de Belfi?
I saw some watts per kilogram and climbing times, yeah.
Yeah, I seen someone had up 6.9 for the climb, 6.9 watts per kilogram. And then after that, in the tread, all I seen after this was like, if it seems too good to be true, it is too good to be true. We've been here before. And like, I don't know, for me, you know, I'm not from that era of, you know, the Tyler Hamilton era. I had him on the podcast and he spoke about it. For me, you know, Pogacar doesn't have any history of doping infractions. It's almost like, why can't people believe in a talent? Is there any sort of, you know, view inside the bunch that this kid is just a wonder, or is he treated with a bit of suspicion?
I don't know him at all personally. I mean, I'm much older. He's only pro since 1.5 years, if I'm correct. I actually saw a number that said 6.5 for 16 minutes, which I personally must say is high. I mean, high level, obviously, but it didn't seem crazy when I looked at the, you know, when I was watching it and just realizing how quickly he went up and so on. I expected more. Obviously, I can't push 6.5 watts per kilogram for that. But it didn't. It wasn't for me something that seemed crazy or unbelievable, like you mentioned.
It's only 2 seconds. Obviously, there was also than Aru's time.
Exactly, and when we're talking times, I mean, I don't know, but there's also wind playing a big factor. There is also material which is completely different from 5 years ago when Aho did this time on. I mean, if he was using already time trial tires on the road bike, this is a big difference. And so there are some things you can't really compare just purely on climbing times, because material changed and it's a shorter. I mean, that was a road race, so. Yeah, tactics were involved. You know, there were maybe some people were looking at each other. Here, he just went all in for 16 minutes. Obviously, he did already a 40-minute effort on the flat and so on. It's hard to come, but just purely on the climbing times, and the number I saw 6.5. I didn't see 6.8. If that's that would change a little bit, but 6.5 that didn't seem for me crazy. And it took like a minute or 50 seconds on Tom Dumoulin, but Tom Dumoulin riding on a TT bike, you know, wasting 2 kilograms and just a different, not a good setup for climbing.
You think that was a mistake, not changing bikes at the bottom?
No, I think it wasn't. It was just calculated, in my opinion. He thought for him, I don't know, but Wout van Aert, he changed bikes and also did a really good time. I don't know what I would have. I mean, for sure, yeah, he calculated it. He didn't do it based on feeling only. So,
yeah,
he for sure had his idea, but others had a different idea.
Alex, you mentioned tires there, and I think that's something that a lot of people listening to the podcast won't understand the difference they make. What tires are you guys using for time trials? And just talk us through a little bit of the difference between a road tire and a time trial tire.
Well, yeah. Ryan is more of an expert, but he taught me just some things. There are obviously, you know, the slower, the faster you want to go, the lighter the tire needs to be, or the wider it has to be. All these have effects on speed, but also on comfort and on durability. And so, for a time trial, you would try to just get the fastest tire, maybe having less grip in the corners or so. There's always a trade-off. There's probably more puncture probability in there, which you don't want in a tire for road race, because it's just much longer. And, you know, you probably have downhills and different road asphalt and so on. That is basically the deal. I mean, that's just for a training tire, it's just super big. It's very comfortable. It has a lot of grip. You never puncture, but you're also very, very slow.
Yeah, I remember for me, the first time I really hit home the difference it makes is inside on a velodrome, like riding a pursuit. I mean, you go from training tires to race tires. You can be lapping like half a second faster per lap, which...
Yeah. It is. Difference is huge. Difference is for sure. And then there's difference between... For sure, it's a difference between brands. Now, I'm not an expert on which brand is exactly faster and so on, but for sure, there's a difference between even a road race tire and a time trial tire, and then there's a huge difference between a training tire and a racing tire.
You were on the long list, Alex, this year for Tour of France selection, am I right?
Yeah.
Is that difficult to miss out on? And then the follow-up to that, are you hoping to ride some of the other Grand Tours this season?
For sure, it was difficult to... I was disappointed because, first of all, I was happy because it helped me to be motivated throughout the whole lockdown thing and so on, and could really, it was some kind of goal that was above anything else, so that really pushed me reaching a higher level. And then of course, when you did all the sacrifices and training during these quarantine times and doing altitude camps and seeing yourself being in the best shape probably ever, not being selected is disappointing, of course, but I just use that shape, try to refocus and use it for different races.
Will you kick on for a Giro or a Vuelta?
So that was even more disappointing, because I knew the Tour was my only chance for Grand Tour this year, as I'm pretty important for the Classic team. So the Classics are the races I will do at the end of the season, which go on at the same time as the Giro and the Vuelta.
Looking at the guys you have in the squad, like, you know, you've Nibali, you've obviously a world champion for another week anyway, Mads Pedersen, Richie Porte, Bulk Mollema, like, is it kind of pinch me at times going, oh my God, some of the biggest stars in the sport, you know, they're my teammates, they're my friends. are you learning so much off these type guys?
No, I don't look like. I try to learn, obviously, from someone who is better than me or can do at least in something better than me. But no, I'm more looking at it as a job, and I show up to the races and do what I'm asked for and do what I'm good at. I'm also a little bit older now already, even that. It's only now my second year at World Tour level, but I'm pretty experienced and actually more trying to teach younger riders than teaching myself.
But like with your characteristics, it looks like you could potentially win a classic, you know, maybe not this season, might be too early. I don't know what your condition's like, but you must have your eye on a classic win.
Sure. No, yeah, of course, that's a dream, and I believe I'm not ready yet, for sure not. I think we have to, as a rider, you have to be very, you have to pay attention to what you're aiming for, because it is a business, it's a job, and you have to do what you're best at. At the moment, I believe I'm one of the best helpers in the World Tour. And it would be very dangerous to, for my career to ride egoistically, just to get more results, personal results.
Yeah.
So I think you have to carefully choose your spot within the team, and that can make a more successful career and longer career.
It's interesting.
But I think on a good day and out of the right breakaway and so on, I hope that I'm able to do a really good result in a classic at one point in my career.
It's interesting because I had Mitch Docker on the podcast a while ago, and Mitch is obviously coming towards the end of his career. And he was talking about just the changing roles he's had within the team through the years, because he said, like exactly like you're talking about, he said, you need to look at it as a job. And then within this job, you have all the different roles that need to be filled. So he has needed to look at it and thought, okay, with my characteristics, which role can I fill best? And he said, from season to season, that's actually changed. He said, because you have to adapt from pure lead out man to, oh, all of a sudden we're going for the green jersey now. So I need to be a lead out man, but I also need to be able to get over kind of medium mountains and be there at the far side. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be a challenge to keep kind of refining yourself or redefining yourself.
I believe you're right. I think for the moment I just try to become my personal goal is to become the best domestic possible, in a sense that I don't really focus on getting one climb better, but just being the best in everything I can and giving a big value to the team by just being longer in the climbs with the GC riders and being longer in the finals of classics for the leader and doing good. Yeah, right now I'm more focused on doing lead outs in the sprints and so on. So just getting into this so that you can actually get used for many different scenarios, and that will make for a good career, I think. Or that's my strategy, at least.
You had kind of an unusual route into cycling, because you started out and you were with the Trek development team, the Trek Leopard?
Yeah, exactly.
And then you took your stagiaire with Trek, and you went pro-Conti mm-hmm. the following year, but then you actually took some time out and went back to college and studied economics?
No, I mean, I studied economics, but from after high school immediately. So basically next to writing for Leopard development and then still the first 2 years at being professional.
And was it okay balancing training and college at the same time?
It wasn't easy, and for sure it cost me a little bit of time in cycling, or it slowed me down a little bit. That's for sure. You can't have, you know, you can't do both 100% in anything. You need to be fully focused to do something really good. But I'm really happy I did it this way. I wouldn't want to change anything, because once I came out of high school, I wasn't that super talented rider. I was for sure lucky that Leopard development team was based in Luxembourg. It was a great team, and I was one of the, let's say, the talented riders in Luxembourg. But you know, I was lucky that I got a spot and could develop there slowly. I never felt like it was a security for me to pass professional, and I always wanted to be able to decide on what job I want to do.
Do you feel like it was a safety net for you? Like, it gave you confidence? I know I raced in France, and I was riding for a division national team over there, and I finished law school when I was in France, and my real mate, who was another Irish rider, he was the Irish under 23 champion that year, he dropped out of high school to come to France and race. And going into races, I could just feel like, especially a big race, it was just very different, because for me, I had in the back of my mind, you know, if this doesn't work out, I can still go home and I'm going to have a career. Yeah. Whereas he was just so stressed all the time, and he found it difficult to enjoy the racing, and he just thought, this is it, I have to make it, or else like I'm on the scrap heap.
Yeah, sure. For sure, that was some kind of safety net. And I think my career also took off in a sense that once I finished university, there was like a much more time, obviously, for training, but there was also just this big security that I could find not even a well-paid job. Obviously, you also try to be well-paid, but just a job that I like, and just have more freedom. So for sure that helped me a lot, and it was also that thing, at that time I was saying, if I manage to do this now, I can do anything. It was kind of, you know, once you do something really hard and you manage to do it, then it just gives you more confidence and more strength to take on new challenges.
For sure, you draw experiences like that. I remember the year I was doing the entrance exams for law school, I also got my master's in law at the same year, and I was training that year. And I remember, just in times I've been busy since, just thinking back, and that's my new reference point, where I think, you know what, I was super busy. I rode, I think, the World University Championships or something that year, so I had pretty good condition. And I got my master's and I got accepted into law school. And now I kind of, when I find myself busy and I have a couple of podcast episodes to record and some bits to get, I'm like, cop on. Like, you're not as busy as you were then. Soak it up.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, for sure. That is not only in cycling related. It, you know, just sometimes we have to do some hard things, and they will bring us forward.
Have you settled into being a World Tour rider now? I know when I talk to a lot of guys, especially guys who are, you know, inside the first 5 years of being a World Tour rider, they're almost afraid to jinx it. And they're afraid to, like Mitch Docker spoke about how he was living in Girona for 10 years and he still didn't feel like he could properly unpack in his apartment. He didn't feel like it was home because he thought, maybe I won't get a contract next year. Maybe I'll have to go back to Australia. So, what's the point in buying the couch? What's the point in buying the lamp?
Yeah.
Are you finding that, or are you feeling settled?
No, I feel pretty much settled. I don't want to sound that in an arrogant way, but for me, there was the long term, even that, how can I say this now? I always wanted to become a World Tour rider, even when I was 18 or 19 years and not at all so far away from that level. going through university, and so that the goal was always to end up in the World Tour. And it took me 4 years on Pro Conti level, really fighting hard, let's say, because life is really tough on Pro Conti level. The people are tough, and the racing is tough. You know, there's basically no support. And all I did, you know, all that kept me going was, you know, ending up in the World Tour. So once I actually signed with Trek, life became easy because you have finally, you're in one of the best teams in the world. You have coaches that support you. You have a whole team that is just standing behind you and making life easy, basically.
Do you base yourself in Luxembourg now for training?
Yeah.
What's Luxembourg like for terrain and training partners?
It is perfect. It is hilly. Just, you know, no flat, and basically no flat. You have climbs from 5 to 15 minutes effort. Pretty good weather, obviously in the winter a bit colder. Good for traveling to races. Just general good lifestyle.
You're not tempted to do the Monaco or Andorra thing like a lot of the guys seem to be doing?
Not at all. Not even 1 second. I'm pretty sure most riders would perform much better if they wouldn't live where they in Spain or wherever they just move now.
Well, like, I can see Girona. Like, I love Girona. I try and get over there whenever I can because it's a cool town. But for me, if I was a pro cyclist, I don't know if I'd love it. It feels like it's too claustrophobic with pros.
So my opinion, but everyone is obviously different, is that if you choose a place to live for a job, and this is cycling is a job, you should always try to understand. Could you imagine having a family there? You know, growing up a family, because a cycling career could, you know, you could become actually a father. Well, there's high chance you become a father or get married, have a wife, that she needs to work at the place where you live. So can you imagine having a life on that place? Yeah. I personally couldn't imagine my kids going to school in Spain. So for me, it was never an option to move up from Luxembourg.
Well, definitely that's what gets me with Andorra. Like, I was over to Andorra a couple of years ago, and it's like, there's nothing there. Like, I'm sure it's cool like to go on holidays and go skiing and stuff for a week of cycling, but there's not much in Andorra, and it must be pretty full on, like borderline depressing at times living there.
Yeah, for sure. Andorra is more for tax reason than anything else, because it makes otherwise no sense to live in Andorra. But just in general, this whole you have to move to the south thing is, for me, it's a little bit soft to say, it's a little bit colder in my place in November and so on.
It's like a true classics, man.
Yeah, but isn't it like this? You also actually nowadays with seasons finishing mid-October, you have the first training camp already in December. In January, you start racing end of January. You don't really train so much in the cold, don't you?
Well, like it rains every fucking day here in Ireland. So, like, I have friends in America, and they're like, "Oh, don't train in the rain." And I'm like, if you didn't train in the rain and you lived in Ireland, you would be fucking never go on your bike.
Yeah. Well, Mads Pedersen is world champion, and he lives in Denmark. There's no single meet of climbing, and don't think he sees the sun a lot of times. But he's still the best rider in the world right now.
Yeah, for one more week.
But just what I want to say is that I think it's more important you live on a place where you're actually happy, where you might have your family around you, where you just feel home, and there's a nice culture next to cycling maybe. And I think that this gives you more energy for good racing than maybe, you know, some training group or whatever.
Is there good cycling culture in Luxembourg?
There is actually. There's pretty many Luxembourgish professionals now. There used to be a lot of Danish riders living here back in the days. Yeah.
It's intermission time. It's been a while since I said that on a long form Roadman podcast. Guys, if you're enjoying today's podcast and all the other podcast content that I'm bringing to you 5 days a week on the Roadman Cycling platform, please consider heading on over to patreon.com/Anthony_Walsh. Make a small donation of the price of a beer once a month, and that really ensures the future of this podcast. Sorry for the interruption, and let's get back to chatting with Alex. I seen an interesting article you had online. I think it was on the Trek website, and you know that crap question that everybody always asks: if you had a dinner party and you could only invite three people. But I thought your answer was interesting because it's not the usual. You always see these questions asked for cyclists, and the answer is like, "Oh, Eddie Merckx, Laurent Fignon, and Miguel Indurain, or something." Yours was all business guys. I think it's like Steve Jobs, Warren Buffett, and Bill Gates. That's pretty atypical for a cyclist. Kind of what led you to be so interested in kind of innovation, business, and entrepreneurship?
Oh, it's just really interesting, isn't it? I try to see more far ahead than just my cycling career right now. Keeps me also a little bit calm, you know, just not focusing all the time on cycling. And in a sense, cycling is also a business. Our career is very short. We have to look further ahead. I'm not really a businessman in a sense, but I try to set myself up for after my career. And so, yeah, these are very interesting people that I admire for how they change the world. Yeah.
I think it's just, I nearly think they go hand in hand, like the mindset of trying to be a cyclist, especially I know when you get to your level, it's all about, it's a job and it's, you know, fitting into roles. But definitely when you're coming up as a junior and trying to strive for that pro contract, it's a very like growth mindset that you're doing everything you can to try and get better. You're training harder, recovering smarter, and you've just this thirst for knowledge. And I found that for me, when I decided, you know what, I've found my level, I'm not going to get past Continental, I channeled that energy and I turned it over to business. And it's the same sort of mindset and the same questions that I was asking in cycling as how I progress, I now find myself asking those same questions in business. So it's a great outlet for that creativity and passion.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm a big reader, I would say so. If you read books and biographies of just successful people, they are basically all the same, and it doesn't really matter in where they are successful, if it's in sports or just in business. They basically invest in themselves and set really high goals and then try to find a way how to achieve those goals. So yeah, sure.
So I went through kind of an interesting journey, because when I came back from being Continental, I was riding for a team in the US, and I came back to Ireland. And I'd set up a coaching company and that was doing okay, but I had this business head on me now, and I went and set up like four or five other businesses. Like I bought a cycling cafe, I set up a media company, tried to build an app, but I started doing all these things and I've never had any weight on me, you know, as a cyclist or before that, but I started finding I'm trying to balance all this stuff and I'm still trying to ride my bike a little, but I'm starting to put on a little bit of weight. And then I found I was just getting so overwhelmed that I was like almost not as happy as I used to be. And I got to a point where I went to a race and I just got dropped like in the first 4 or 5K. And it wasn't a particularly high level. And coming home from the race, I remember thinking like, shit's just gone wrong for me here. I need to just press pause on everything and figure out my next step. And it was going away and pressing pause on everything that I figured out, look, there's a different way to do this. I can't take the old full-time cycling mentality and then just keep stuffing on like
first business, second business, third business, relationship, eating out in restaurants, drinking wine late at night. Because what happens is it just explodes and everything falls apart. So it took me pressing pause and stepping back to figure out, you know what, there's a different way of doing it. And it's a different skill set when you're trying to balance this stuff. And that transition was real hard for me.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself building businesses on the side as you kind of gravitate towards, you still got a lot of your career left. You're only in your, what are you, second year at World Tour?
Mm-hmm.
But do you see yourself starting to transition towards building businesses on the side or leveraging your personal brand as you go through your career?
I'm open-minded. Let's say like this. I'm not sure if I want to build businesses right now, but things can come quite quickly. So I try. I have some ideas that what I want to do after I finish cycling. So right now I would like to become go back to university for 2 more years and become a professor in economics, something completely different from cycling. Definitely, I opened a restaurant last year in Luxembourg, which because it's not a big business, and I'm not really into managing it right now, so I don't need to spend time on it. But that opened my eyes a little bit on what is still out there, and then I could also imagine myself just finding a job within cycling, which probably 2 years ago I would never have imagined. So I'm pretty open, but the most important is that the cycling career is on track. You shouldn't be too busy on trying to grow something and so on. I think I'm pretty much set up for a job after cycling with my degree and a little bit of money on the side to afford going back to university. And so there should be 100% focus on just a cycling career. But if there is something coming along, you should be prepared to go for it.
What's your cycling? Is it a cycling themed restaurant or just a regular themed restaurant?
No, cycling theme. Yeah.
What's it called?
Gruppetto.
Oh, cool. Well, definitely. You have to pop me a link to that, and I'll throw it into the show notes for people to check out. Before we finish up, Alex, we couldn't have you on without getting a prediction for the weekend for the Worlds. Who's it going to be?
Oh, I haven't thought about it at all. It's going to sound boring, but it's hard to say because the mental toll on the Grand Tour is big. So if you look at just the shape out of the Tour, Wout van Aert should be for sure a big favorite. Now is the question if you can hold on to that momentum. Because you could also, if you relax too much, your body tension is fading, and you kind of just get really tired, I guess.
I guess it's got to be difficult to manage the period. Well, it's only 7 days between the Tour finishing and the Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know there's probably no party. How did the team celebrate last night? Was there a party here or just in food?
I don't know, but I don't think so. Yeah, probably just dinner.
Yeah, that's got to be pretty shit if it's your first Tour de France and you're waiting for that party.
I also don't think that that Jumbo-Visma had a lot to celebrate on Sunday evening. But
Fuck, they must have been just so good. What's the story with Jumbo-Visma in the bunch? I heard a couple of whispers that they're not particularly well liked. Is there any truth to that?
Not that I know of, but I read that article of Eddie Max saying they wrote stupidity as stupid, and I must agree that they didn't write on a very clever way this Tour de France. They for sure used a lot of resources, and who knows if that is what cost Roglic the win on the second last day.
But
I mean, if I would have been sports director, I would have done it completely different. And I guess Ineos did it also very different the last years, although...
It's obviously easy for us as armchair critics to criticize him now, but it just seems to me obvious that you need to use Dumoulin. Like, he's a valuable lieutenant as a domestique, but much greater value if you can keep him close on the general and then put him up the road and force UAE to chase.
Yeah, that is even further ahead in tactics, but there were even some days where they should have let the breakaway just get 15 minutes and take a rest day. Because even it's not only the teammates that couldn't rest at all, but also the way they rode, Roglic had to use a lot of energy in some of the semi-climbing stages that could have been on paper. It's never rest day, but also mentally less stressful day, a little bit like Ineos were doing these the last years. Basically every team did this the last years, and they took on like more or less every stage from the gun, and by doing that they even lost two times, I guess.
But if you're in the bunch, like, is that just so fucking annoying where you're just saying, like, chill out, what are you doing? And it's meant to be an easy day where the break gets 15, 20 minutes and goes to the finish, and they're just riding all day. Like, that can't make them massively popular.
Yeah, I mean, I never did a race with them being so strong. So I wasn't there, but in the end, every team has the right to ride the way they do. We are not friends together. I mean, we are paid by a team and should do what the sports director says, but obviously it didn't work out, and I think they could have done differently.
For me, what was interesting was in recent years, we're so used to, you know, Ineos or Sky winning the Tour de France, that Brailsford is so cautious in the final days of the Tour de France, even when, you know, Froome or Thomas or Bernal, even when they had a big lead, he was still so cautious, saying, you know, it's not over till it's over. But the Jumbo-Visma director was basically, like, interviews I was seeing, he was almost celebrating before it was done. And they even had an ad in the Dutch newspaper I seen today, like, basically congratulating Roglic on the Tour de France win, like, 2 days before it was finished. It was crazy.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't... Yeah. I mean, the way they wrote, I wouldn't have imagined his TT performance being below average, but it's true. But they did a very impressive job in the climbs. That's true. But the race is never over until it's over. You know, even in Paris, you can crash or whatever.
So, what's up next for you, Alex? Are you going to ride the classics?
Yeah, I do a Bing Bong Tour and then the classics.
Nice. And if someone wants to follow up with you on social media and kind of follow along the journey for the rest of the season, where's the good places to catch up with you?
I prefer Instagram and Twitter. So I have both accounts, but something like Kirsch Alex or Alex Kirsch. You'll probably find them.
And I'll put the links in the description to this podcast down below for anyone. Alex Kirsch, thank you for joining us, and thanks for giving us a little glimpse inside the peloton.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hey everybody, it's Anthony again. Really quick, I want to invite you to join arguably the best thing I've ever put out inside the Roadman community. It's a challenge. It's a challenge called the 14-Day Kickstart Challenge. So regardless of where your fitness is at right now, this is going to be the catalyst for making you faster and making you leaner. I've created this challenge to take the guesswork out of everything. It's 14 days of training plans, regardless of what your level is. There's masters, beginner, advanced. There's meal plans, shopping list, and even a video course holding your hand and talking you through it all. So what I recommend you do right now is just stop everything, press pause on this audio, and go to roadmancycling.com/14day, or check out the link in the bio. That's roadmancycling.com/14day.